Well, in 1998, I graduated law school in Manhattan in New York. And so as one does when one graduates from school, I was looking for a job. And actually, I got an offer from a great law firm in downtown Manhattan at One Liberty Plaza across the street from the World Trade Center. And I almost took that job, but my ex was a mixer, an audio engineer, and he ended up getting this really great gig in L.A. So we moved to L.A. instead, and I got a job at a law firm there. But a lot of my friends from law school remained in New York. And so it was with a particular kind of horror that I watched the events of 9/11 unfold. And, you know, at first, as I was watching the news that day, I just, I'm sure, felt the way all of us felt, which was total shock and disbelief and absolute horror at what was going on. And as the day unfolded, it occurred to me that I could have easily been there and to wonder whether any of my friends were there. It wasn't until much later that I found out, indeed, one of my classmates from law school was on the 103rd floor of the North Tower. And somehow, his name was Paul Acquaviva, and after the plane hit, somehow he had time to call his pregnant wife, Courtney. He called her because he was worried about her and their 2-year-old daughter and their unborn son. And he called to tell her that he loved her and that his prayers would always be with her, and that he understood there was no way he was getting out of the building. You know, when things like that happen, I think our natural result, our natural response is to do anything we can to try to have some kind of control, to regain control in our life, so that we can re-achieve a measure of safety, any kind of safety that we can. And unfortunately, right now, the world community is having again to find out how we are going to respond to really apocalyptic events, which because of what happened in Paris on Friday. And you know, I actually think that desire to reassert some kind of control is at the heart of the disciples' question to Jesus in today's gospel text. Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple, which was to first century Jews as apocalyptic an event to first century Jews in Palestine as the destruction of the Twin Towers was to 21st century Americans, or as the massacres this year have been to French people in Paris. So when Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple, the disciples ask him when, Jesus, is this going to happen, and what will be the sign that it happens? And it's kind of hard to know if they're asking this out of total disbelief, you know, like, what, when, how could such a thing ever happen? I mean, these stones are pretty big, right? How could it happen? But I think somewhere in there is also a question about, give me any information I can have so that I can avoid it, so that I can get my family out and warn my neighbors, or maybe so that I can stay and fight. I don't know. But give me some information. I think that the French president, he controlled the borders of his country and he declared a state of emergency. There were debates for years after 9/11 debating how much control should we allow our government to have nationally and internationally. To prevent an action like that ever happening again. So we really desperately seek to have control when apocalypse threatens. But you notice that Jesus does not answer his disciples' questions about when will this happen. He does begin to describe in more detail the kind of suffering that they're going to undergo. And then he says something very odd. He says, these are just the beginnings of the birth pangs. Now, I don't know about you, but the metaphor of birth is a very odd one to put, to compare with apocalypse. It sits very uneasily on my ears. But I wonder if somehow Jesus is trying to hint that there will be life again afterward. It's hard for us to hear that. I think the text from 1 Samuel actually can give us a lot of help along these lines, beginning to work through and process what we do in face of apocalypse and infertility and loss. Hannah was not going through apocalypse. She was going through infertility, which I suppose might feel similar to some people. I don't know if any of you have struggled with infertility. My husband and I have journeyed along that road. And finally, we did end up having our beautiful daughter. We call her our miracle baby. It was a miracle that we had her, and we are so grateful for her. But I know the ongoing anguish of infertility. And for Hannah, though, it was beyond what I could ever imagine, because Hannah was a woman of her time. And in those days, the only available vocation for a woman that was at all respectable was to become a mother. So that becoming a mother was her social value in life. Without it, she was considered cursed by God. So in addition to just the overall desire to have a child, she needed to have a child to be socially, to have any kind of social standing. And furthermore, there was no social security in those days, right? She needed a child to have someone to take care of her when she grew old. Otherwise, she would be bereft. And so it's with all of that roiling in her that she, in today's text, comes to God. And she engages the wonderful and ancient Judeo-Christian practice of lament, which is just the remarkable thing of bringing your anguish to God. It's amazing. The other day I was complaining about something and somebody said, "Have you prayed about that?" And I was like, "What a concept." So Hannah brings her anguish to God, right? And she makes this strange vow. She promises God, "If you will just give me a son, I will give him back to you." Now that's another thing that sits oddly on my ears. As somebody who has desperately wanted a child and finally been granted one, I don't really like the quid pro quo that represents, you know, I'm thinking no. I'm not giving her back. You know, the more I studied this text, though, the more I came to understand, I don't think that's what it is. I don't think Hannah is offering God some kind of unfair bargain. I think what she's doing is saying to God, "I will trust you to give me what I need. If you will just make my life generative, I will give up the security and the tight-fisted control over the way I think my life needs to go, over the personal benefits that I think will accrue to me by having a child." I think she's stepping forth in a radical kind of faith in God and saying, "Make my life generative, and I will surrender my future to you. I will release my control over the future." And God grants her request. And not only that, but her son Samuel ends up being this amazing judge in the history of Israel who moves Israel from a time of anarchy under the judges to the united monarchy under King David. It's a very pivotal time in the history of Israel. And so Samuel is generative for the whole nation, not just for Hannah. And isn't that exactly the essence of what we mean when we say gospel? God brings life out of barrenness. God brings generativity out of infertility. God brings resurrection out of crucifixion. This is our God. This is what God does. Well, about a month ago, I was at a retreat called Living in the Green. And it was a retreat that was I was invited to because I'm involved with launching something. It was, anyway, the retreat was for people who were launching new things in the Episcopal Church in Minnesota. So I am on the team that is working on bringing a Minnesota unit of the Episcopal Service Corps here. The Episcopal Service Corps is this incredible one-year residence for young adults who want to live together in intentional Christian community and offer their lives in service to and solidarity with the poor. And so it's very exciting that we're going to bring a unit of this to Minnesota. And I'm involved in that team, so I got invited to participate in this retreat called Living in the Green. And at that retreat, I don't know what, I think I was expecting, you know, strategic planning or something. But wow, it was not that. At this retreat, we were invited to tell our individual and communal stories for the sake of answering two questions. What is God calling us to let go of? And what future is God inviting us into? And the two questions are linked because sometimes we need to let go of something in order to be able to step into the future to which God calls us. So we wrestled with this for days. It was an incredible experience. And you'll never guess where it came from. I'm going to tell you one more story and then I will tie it in. I promise I will answer the question. So the day after 9/11, there was just one building in the several block radius around the Twin Towers that was still standing, completely unscathed. And it was the tiny little St. Paul's Episcopal Chapel next door. Somehow, there was no damage to the building. And interestingly, it had been declining. Its membership had kind of dried up, and so it was slated to become a museum. But the day after 9/11, the clergy and lay leaders of that church decided that the only thing they could do with their building that had been spared was to offer it. So they put this little handwritten sign on the door that said, "Open 24/7 for prayer and food." 4 days later, it became ground zero for the rescue effort, and thousands of people came through the building offering their services of all kinds to support the rescue effort and then the cleanup for 260 days. And I read about the news reports about this thing, and it was the people who gathered there called it a circle of generosity unlike anything they'd ever seen. People were literally trying to outdo each other in how they could help. And this incredible community was formed. And as this community was being formed organically, they started noticing that there were these organic practices that the community was regularly engaging in just almost by accident. They were telling stories. They were naming things they were grateful for. They were naming what they needed to let go of. They were naming the future that God was inviting them into. You see where I'm going with this? The practices that organically evolved out of that community, they noticed them, they named them, and they realized they could use them in other contexts to create the same kind of community without requiring the apocalypse to make it happen as the foundation of community. So they did. And that codifying of those practices became the retreat, Living on the Green, that I just went to. Living in the Green is the spiritual descendant of the life God birthed in the aftermath of 9/11. It is bearing fruit all over the country. I mean, lots and lots of places are using those practices to begin to ask the question, what is God calling us to let go of? And what future is God inviting us into? Well, I think the people of St. Matthew's right now are neither in a time of apocalypse nor in a time of infertility. This is a wonderful, thriving community. And we are listening in all kinds of ways or trying to listen for where God is leading us. But I think the temptation to control our future is always with us. It is for me. I'm about to graduate from another school. And how many degrees do you need in your life? But anyway, and I'm going to look for a job too. So, and in case you don't know this, preachers really write sermons for themselves and hope it will be helpful to everybody else. What I think these texts from today and the stories that I've shared with you, what I hope they're inviting us to do is really to cultivate a culture here at St. Matthew's where we are constantly asking the questions, what is God calling us to let go of? And what future does God want to birth among us? What does God want us to let go of? And what future is God inviting us into? Amen.